Neva, thank you very much, and it is a great pleasure to be here. It's a high honor to receive this prize, especially alongside Angus Deaton. Angus, as you were speaking, I reflected on a great many things that I did not know that we had in common. Quite apart from the most obvious one, our common roots in the old country of Scotland. But my father, too, contracted and survived tuberculosis in his youth in Canada. He was, as Vasily Leontief would have approved, an agricultural economist. And he made the greatest thing. At his memorial in 2006, George McGovern spoke of having encountered him on one occasion on an airplane. And late at night, Dad, as usual, was working. George sat down next to him and said, Ken, do you ever get tired of the life of flying? Ken said, George, when I do, I think of my alternative, which was farming. McGovern said, as he related that story, right away, I felt better. I also should perhaps note, just parenthetically, that once, for a short while, as a teenager, I dated a girl whose father had been an escape officer for the RAF in one of the German prisoner of war camps. I had, I think, been involved in the making of the film, The Great Escape. On an occasion such as this, one owes the audience a brief, modest, and not overly imaginary account of why it might have been merited. I'm tempted to ask, to begin with, how did you find me? Certainly not, or at least I strongly suspect not, by trolling the classification codes of the Journal of Economic Literature. The subject on which I work, which is roughly the macroeconomics of inequality at the world scale, doesn't even exist so far as the classification schemes of economic literature are concerned. To the profession, inequality is a topic for markets. It is substantially about supply and demand, skills on one side, education on the other. I don't think so. And Robert Lucas and I do not agree on much. We do agree that the distinction between macro and microeconomics is an artificial one which should be abolished. Our slight difference of view is over which of the two branches should be thrown out in favor of the other. A second difficulty that you may have faced has to do with the status hierarchies in economics. What I do is roughly the policy implications of exploratory data analysis, which ranks, and I think Angus will confirm this, at the bottom of the status hierarchies of our profession, roughly alongside the rereading of the great works of John R. Commons and Henry George. One might have called this the Leontief Prize for toiling a long time in obscurity. Of course, as you realize, Vasily Leontief, who was my first instructor in economics, would have liked that. On the first day of class, this would have been in 1970, I believe, I remember vividly a large poster full of numbers under the heading, "The Economy of the United States." It was his input-output matrix in real life. He believed in the application of fact to policy. And for that belief, he experienced, in spite of his renown in the world and his Nobel Prize, the downgrading over time that goes to overly practical people. There was a moment a few years later when he was speaking to my father, and they paused to calculate how many votes each of them would have gotten if their case for tenure were presented to the faculty at that time. My father came up with 8. The ceiling had come up with 9. So that raised a question. My dad asked to see Vasily's list, and he said, "Vasily, you can't vote for yourself for tenure." To which the impeccable logician replied, "Why not? I'm a tenured member of this department." I was drawn in to work on inequality now quite a long time ago, middle 1990s, by the 20th Century Fund as it then was. And from the start, it seemed to me that the questions that I was being asked to look at could not be answered persuasively from the evidence that was then at hand. And it became clear that there was a problem with the character of the evidence. Sample surveys were the fruits of immense, determined, difficult, and honest labor, but, and particularly when collected over time or across large numbers of countries, they were limited, noisy, inconsistent in the concepts that they measured, sparse, and very expensive. On the other hand, there was a lot of information of an administrative, geographic, sectoral, or industrial sort that was plentiful, reasonably consistent, extremely cheap to acquire, and neglected. And the question arose as to whether that material could be exploited for useful information about the problem, which was the level and change over time of economic inequality. It seemed to me that it could. And an encounter with the writing of the Chicago-based econometrician Henri Pyle suggested a very easy way of proceeding. So Tile's little toy became my hammer, and for many years thereafter, practically any number that I came across looked to me like a nail. Why use this approach? Well, perhaps you remember the bi-colored python rock snake in Kipling's How the Elephant Got Its Trunk. First advantage. You can calculate dense, consistent time series of inequality from many different sources this way, and you can compare them. Second advantage. If it happens to be the case that multiple jurisdictions, say countries, or within a country, provinces or states, happen to adopt or are obliged to adopt a common category scheme, then it turns out you can also compare the inequality in one place with the inequality in someplace else. Third advantage, having to do with the nature of these statistics, which can be added and up together and decomposed, you can group things up or down at will and in a consistent way.
going from in the United States counties to states to countries or across countries to whole continents or to the world as a whole. Or you can do the same thing, for example, with a hierarchy of industrial classifications, going from 4-digit to 3-digit to 2-digit levels or the other way. Fourth advantage, you can pick out, without benefit of regression or anything complicated, just by visual inspection, who the actual winners and losers in relative terms are over time. It gives you a very clear picture, and I'll show you a little bit momentarily. Fifth advantage, you can extract common trends across countries or any other unit that you're observing, even at the global level, so you can get some sense of the interdependence, regional, interregional, across time, and therefore of the macroeconomic character of events affecting economic inequality. So rather than taking as an a priori truth that what you're looking at is the supply and demand in some previously defined market, say the labor market of Belgium, you can ask the question, is what's going on here something that originates inside the jurisdiction you're looking at, or is it part of something that is a larger common phenomenon and therefore likely to have a common or an external source? And the sixth advantage, which I will come to now, is that you can take these measures, which are not easy to interpret as pure numbers. They're only really meaningful in comparative sense, in a contrasting framework. And you can convert them into the standard metric, which is Gini coefficient, that everybody else uses, and therefore make an effort to assess how these numbers fare in relationship to the literature at large. And that's what the small piece of the work that we've been doing, that is in fact most recent, just coming out of my little kitchen workshop in the last few months, that I would like to spend a little time talking about and showing you just now. So if you thought you were going to get through this afternoon's presentation without a slideshow and without having to focus your attention on some data, I hate to disappoint you. We did not know, of course, in calculating these measures, whether our estimates were really consistent with those other people had been finding. So I set a very talented student to work, going through the literature for a series of countries and simply recording from the papers what the measures of inequality were and what concept was associated with each one. And what we did was to plot them with a color scheme, where green represents the so-called market-based incomes, typically the most unequal. Red represents disposable income after taxes and transfer, the inequality thereof, typically the most equal. Blue is gross household income inequality, which is close to what we are trying to estimate, and black is our measure. Here is, for example, Canada. And you can see, just as I have said, the red numbers, which can be quite diverse according to studies and differences of concepts and sources, tend to lie at the bottom of the graph. The green numbers tend to lie at the top, the blue in the middle. And I'm happy to report that our estimate for this particular case is not only consistent in trends with the other series, but lies roughly where we hoped it would, in the range of other gross household income inequality measures. It should strike you as quite remarkable that anybody faced with a literature like this could say something like, according to the World Bank, the Gini coefficient for Canada is X. An utterly meaningless statement, which could represent anything across the range of roughly 25 to roughly 50, right? Unless you're clear about what it is you're speaking of. Here's a similar chart for a very small, very disciplined, orderly country, namely Denmark. It's just taken from the published literature in economics with our measure, which again happily falls relatively close to other consistent measures and in the middle of the range. Here it is for Germany. Again, the same story, and I have a bunch of them, so there's no real point in dwelling on them in individual detail. They all tell approximately the same story. This is moving away from the best-known country, the Czech Republic, relatively egalitarian country where inequality shifted dramatically after 1989. Russia, a similar story following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Well-known cases, heavily studied cases in the United Kingdom and the United States. Our measures are, I should say, pretty good for countries where incomes are primarily dominated by earnings. Not so great for the case, for example, of the United States, where a substantial share of the inequality is clearly driven by the environment into which Angus's grandchildren are being raised, namely the top 0.01%. And you can see that in the two peaks in the middle of that diagram that are closely associated with the movements of the stock market to peaks in 2000 and 2007. To clarify the U.S. case, well, let me just kind of look at a bit of conclusions, which are, first of all, that the measures in the literature are extremely messy. There are large differences between market gross and net income inequality. Our measures, we believe, do appear to provide reasonably consistent and comparable estimates, although we concede that they are not perfect. To clarify the situation of the United States, just using our data, one can find other sources which give you essentially the same result. This is tax records across counties, the inequality thereof calculated year by year from local area personal income statistics, and you can see very clearly the peak in 2000, the peak in 2007. I'm quite confident that when we have data going for to the next stock market peak, you'll see yet another tooth in the sawtooth pattern that has emerged. It's in fact clear to me that for the United States, the measurement of taxable income inequality is not really necessary. You can simply turn on the television and watch the ticker go by, and it will tell you what is going to be happening to tax records as the stock market goes up and down. But with county-based data, one can in fact do a great deal of detailed analysis. This is just one way of presenting the winners and the losers by county in the middle 2000s in the course of the real estate boom. I'm afraid with the lights you can't see quite as well as I can on my chart, but you can certainly see the booms, first of all, around Silicon Valley in Southern California and in parts of Florida, which were associated with activity at that particular moment. It goes away at other periods of this analysis. It's actually quite a changeable pattern of who the large income winners in a big country are at any given time, although there is one county which is always at the peak of the peak, and that is, of course, New York, New York, Manhattan, the incomes recorded on Wall Street, as you would expect. Looking over the entire globe and at the distribution of measures in our latest version of this data set, you get something like this, recorded the distribution of the means, the maximum, and the minimum. I won't go into that. Looking at it by country from low to high, this is roughly the spectrum with minima and maxima also recorded. That's not a time trend, that's just the ranking of countries from low to high. This one here is the late and unlimited German Democratic Republic. And just looking at the measures across time, I give you the changes at different percentiles of the distribution, the minimum going up from the bottom, the minimum, the bottom 10%, the bottom the 25th percentile, the mean, the 75th, the 90th, and the maximum. And what you can see here, of course, is that at least some of the changes are associated with rapid rises in the lowest inequality countries with the end of the communist regime. The major, there is, although the scale is very compressed, there is a distinct upward movement mainly through the 1980s and 90s that peaks out around 2000. That upward movement appears to be a bit more pronounced amongst the relatively low-income inequality countries to begin with than amongst the higher inequality countries. So that, just to give you a sense of the kinds of patterns that emerge in this data. Much more will be coming shortly. That is data that is observed at the national level only, but we have a great deal of information that can be gleaned from sources that are readily available at the national scale. We've been tracking measures for China, for example, for many years now. This is the most recent iteration of that. And it tells, I think, a very interesting tale, which, so far as I know, is not yet reflected in the survey literature, but I predict it will be, which is that if you measure inequality across the provinces of China, there was actually a peak quite some time ago. This is around the early 2000s, and a decline ever since as the growth of the advanced sectors in China diffuses from the initial concentration in the south, plus Beijing and Shanghai, to other provinces. And that was whereas the inequality measured across sectors in China continues to increase until 2008, and then it also peaks with the crisis. And sectors in China include finance and utilities and real estate and so forth, which are obviously strongly influenced by the credit cycle, so that after 2008, both of these forces are producing actual declines in inequality in China. So the great rise in inequality in China, which characterized the reform period, appears to have ended now already 6 years ago. And we shall see whether other research backs up that conclusion in due course. To come up with something that, so far as I know, had not been calculated until last week when one of my students did it as a little exercise over a few minutes on Monday morning, we have added up the inequality across sectors and regions, 272 regions and six sectors of all the countries in Europe, right? From Eurostat's Regio data set. And here one can see a very interesting pattern, which is a decline and a sharp decline at the moment of the great financial crisis in 2008. And when you disaggregate this across sectors, it's pretty obvious what is going on. This is a very substantial role of the financial sector across Europe, which is diminished by the effect of the crisis on that sector following 2008. That's simply what is going on in the data for Europe, taken as a single integrated continental economy, which is something we can do with this approach. That is very difficult to do if you are trying to merge survey data from individual countries. It gives you a sense of the flexibility and the range of the approach, and also of the ability to draw a simple conclusion, which is the one that Neva articulated in her introduction, which would have possibly have spared me the entire need to make this presentation, namely that practically everywhere you look in the measurement of inequality in the modern world, you find that a dominant force is the share of income that is accruing to the financial sector. When it goes up, inequality rises. When it comes down, the average numbers decrease. Is this necessarily a good thing? No, because when finance fails, the rest of us fail with it. So we're not necessarily better off simply because inequality numbers have changed. But at the same time, it seems to me reasonable to conclude that relying on the financial sector to be the engine of prosperity produces at least two major difficulties. One of them is that matters become intrinsically unstable because the financial sector is not an enduring source of prosperity, that which goes up in the financial sector typically comes down with a crashing thud in due course, causing a lot of damage when it does. And secondly, so long as this single sector has such a dominant role in the distribution of income, you have a phenomenon where certain places and certain people are extraordinarily rich in comparison to all the others. And here's a little illustration of that for the case of Europe, where the tie-up statistic is being broken up into its components, and you can see the contribution to inequality across all 272 sectors in the continent of just two places, the inner city of London and the town of Paris, which, if you have been there, and certainly if you have been on the real estate market there, you will not be in the least surprised to learn. So it's a way, in some sense, of getting a photographic picture of some of the major features of the world in which we presently live, and I think also of coming to some reasonable conclusions about the precautionary steps that we should be taking, both to provide, as Angus, I think, very accurately and decisively said, more effective and comprehensive systems of social insurance for people who are vulnerable under present conditions, and also a degree of control and stabilization over what will otherwise be a very dangerous commitment to the caprices of the financial sector. Thank you very much, and once again, let me say what an honor and privilege it is to be here.